Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today we've got a real honour. We've got Jacob Field, the author of History, The History of Europe in Bite-Sized Chunks, to talk to us about European history and a range of other fascinating topic areas that go along with that, and Europe's place in the modern world and its ancient and medieval past. So without further ado, here is Jacob Field in conversation with me on the subject of Europe. So great. I thought what we could do to begin with is talk a little bit about your experiences in writing, researching, and the kind of the whole project of the book, and then talk a little bit about some of the kind of the contemporary issues that we are facing at the moment in Europe, and how those, what kind of resonances those have within the kind of the big story of European history.
Sure.
Jacob, you could explain to the listeners a little bit about your background and your interest as well in European history.
Okay, sure. So my background is I have a PhD in history from Newcastle University, and my academic study is about the history of London, particularly the Great Fire of London, and also economic history in the Industrial Revolution and why Britain industrialised first. Mm-hmm. And then I've also written a series of popular history books, starting with One Bloody Thing After Another, which is about the gruesome side of history, moving on to Is Capitalism Working, which is about our modern economy, which plays in a lot of the history of Europe. And then now this book, which is The History of Europe in Bite-Sized Chunks. So this is really a general overview of European history, but only the most interesting, useful and significant bits of it.
Yeah. And what role do you see, I mean, the titles that you've listed there, that are popular histories, what role do you see popular history having in the kind of the wider sort of discourse between academia and shall we say the general public, for want of a kind of a less elitist term?
Yeah, I think it's really essential. You talk, there's words like public engagement or doing history in public, or but really I think what it comes down to is that if you can make popular history with the same sort of academic rigour, so, you know, using trustworthy sources and being critical about them, but also pitch it in a way which people can find interesting and find common ground with people in the past, as well as understanding how they're different, I think you can get a really nice synergy going, because not everyone wants to slog through a 500-page manuscript about medieval illuminated texts, important though they are. But a sort of skilled historian who's writing for the general public can kind of synthesize some of the findings from the more specialist works, mm-hmm. and bring that sort of rigor to it. So I think they sort of have a slightly different audience, the two sides of history. Yeah. But I think overall they should be aiming at the same thing. That's my view of it.
And coming back to the history of Europe in bite-sized chunks, Obviously, the changes that we're experiencing at the moment make European history and Britain's relationship to European history and to Europe crucial for probably pretty much anybody to understand. How much do you feel at the moment, given Brexit and the various crises that are emanating from that, that British people really understand European history? Would you think that that understanding is widespread or fairly limited?
No, well, I think it's very much patchy, and that goes back to how history is taught in schools. Mm-hmm. We kind of set up, well, let's take our closest neighbour, France. You know, France crops up in 1066 as where the Normans come from. They invade, and then you don't hear much from France until World War One breaks out, really.
Yeah.
And it's even rare for schools to cover the French Revolution.
Yes.
Which I find, you know, there's a limited time for history in schools, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a shame that a lot of people can go through the whole education and not think about what a lot of historians, certainly political historians, would say is the most important thing to happen in history.
Yes.
And so certainly, if there's one thing people can get from this book, is that, wow, the French Revolution is really important and has a lot of knock-on effects that are even being felt today.
Sure, sure. Was it not Juan Lai who said, you know, it's too early to say? It's one of those things, isn't it? Like kind of a Churchill quote, greatly attributed, perhaps never actually said. But certainly, I think that there's been, I mean, from my perspective as being a GCSE and A-level history teacher, a huge shift since 2010, just to pick a date out of the air, a huge shift towards kind of a more introspective, British grand narrative of history emerging in the teaching of history in schools. And kind of less of a focus on, as you say, things like the French Revolution, which are of immense kind of general and global importance and significance. The way in which that you've structured the book, I think, is really interesting into these distinct time phases. I noticed that you give a lot of time to Europe's Middle Ages. Again, something that probably most people most people listening in Britain would be aware of the Middle Ages in Britain. Perhaps if you, because this podcast is listened to quite a lot in America, I'm guessing probably the perception of what the Middle Ages were in places like America and around the world via the medium of popular culture is a very anglicised notion. Mm. You know. That film and TV depict, from Robin Hood to King Arthur, but of course it's the Middle Ages. It's not just this kind of international kind of or sort of Europe phenomena of Christendom, but it's a sort of a state of mind, isn't it? The medieval yeah. world, and it's a state of mind that we can look at and identify as being what modernity was not. And so the importance of understanding the Middle Ages is huge. And I think what happens, the way in which I've often tried to kind of translate it to my students is the idea of kind of otherness, that the people of the Middle Ages were really distinctly different in a whole range of ways to where the way in which modern people conceive of the world. Have you found sort of, has that been something that you've seen in some of the research that you've done?
Yeah, I mean, in certain this idea of what Europe is and what Christendom is a really big point. I mean, if we take it to the early medieval period, when we still have, just after the fall of Rome, but when the Byzantine Empire is still in place, you could argue that North Africa is a central part of Christendom, even though geographically it's not part of Europe, but culturally, economically, and politically, it's very much part of the sort of European world.
Yeah.
And then moving into the sort of high medieval period, you get this sense of, as you say, you've got the Christian world, which is becomes conceived of as Europe, and then you kind of have everyone else. Mm-hmm. And you get the boundaries of Europe being pushed out as you have things, for example, like the Northern Crusades. Where you have this great march out towards the Baltic and Scandinavia, and you have the last vestiges of pagan Europe gets pushed out by Christendom. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, we have a sort of conception of Europe expands a little bit in the medieval period to what I think generally people would view of as Europe, kind of like the western bit of the Eurasian landmass.
That western bit of that tiny tip of the Eurasian landmass, in which is bunched in this vast and complex civilization, which seems to have caused both kind of benefits and havoc to the rest of the world. Is there a sense that one of the defining features of Europe has been this sort of sense of siege from the steppes of Russia or from the Islamic world, Europe is hemmed in periodically by existential threats? Has that had a role in shaping kind of European mentalities, do you think?
I think certainly when we look at Central and Eastern Europe, this idea of someone sort of coming over the steppes forms a big part of, you know, folk memory and the national identity. You have things like, even now in the Balkans, for example, the Battle of Kosovo, this great battle between the Principality of Serbia and the Ottomans, is still something which is hugely significant. Mm. And then you have, you know, the Ottoman Empire is still very much felt, you know, only fell just over a century ago. So this idea that you could have everything be swept away, I think, mm-hmm. it doesn't seem like it could happen in the West, although we had the Vikings come and maraud from the North. But certainly if you look at the history of Russia, you have you know, various people, specifically the Mongols, who you know, have authority over Russia for centuries. Mm-hmm. Before the Mongol yoke is being thrown off. So I think that's a really interesting point, in that periodically in European history you have this idea of it could all fall apart and when we're getting invaded from every corner.
And that is, you know, a kind of a key anxiety at the moment with, you know, things like kind of Russian hybrid warfare and the various destabilising effects that Vladimir Putin is having on the European Union. Talking about this, it puts me in mind of an experience I had when I was a newspaper reporter. Many years ago, I went to Kosovo as a reporter with a British Army regiment. And when I was out there, it was just after the Kosovan war had ended. And speaking to people on either side, Albanians and Serbs, it was quite common for the Serbs that I spoke to refer to the Albanian Kosovars as Turks. And that's what they called them. They said, you know, the Turks. Which is obviously kind of code for Islamic, for Muslim, for other, for non-European. And there was this sense in, and you find it in the parts of the Balkans, and I think there's a culture of it in Poland, all along kind of Europe's eastern periphery of, if it, you know, you lot in France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Great Britain, you have it easy. We are holding the line here. We've been holding the line here for a very long time against, you know, the others who would, you know, if it wasn't for us, would have swept all the way to the Channel. In a way, there's a funny kind of pan-Europeanism in that thought, but there's also a funny kind of schism, isn't there, between East and West?
Yeah, I mean, one thing when we were planning the book is I really wanted to have as much Eastern European and Central European history as possible and actually have some sort of balance rather than just concentrating on France, Spain and Germany. Mm. You know, we wanted to put in things like the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, mm-hmm. You know, the Swedish Empire, which people don't really think about, the rise of Russia as a great power. You know, we think of Russia as this huge thing, but it's only relatively recent in the broad sweep of European history that it has been this massive power. And then also I wanted to include a lot about Turkey and the Ottoman Empire, even though geographically only a little bit of Turkey is in Europe. It's had a huge impact on European history, not just Ottoman Empire, but earlier when it was one of the centres of the Byzantine Empire. Mm-hmm. So I think definitely, I think to have an appreciation of Europe, we can't just limit ourselves to Western Europe, because that's just as limiting as, you know, just looking at the British Isles. I think we have to really look outward and to the whole continent.
Well, that's it. And also from the 18th century onwards, it's hard to think of a European history without thinking of a global history. Things become much more complex when you're telling the story of even one European country because of colonialism and empire. Did you find that you got to about the kind of the early modern period and thought, blimey, I've got a whole new book to write?
the happy and sad thing about this book is it's only 192 pages. So there's only so much you can cover. Mm. So although colonialism and imperialism is really vital and it's a huge priority for European nations, I can only touch on it sort of almost thematically to talk about the broad sweep of what happened. Mm-hmm. But certainly if you look at rivalry between the great powers of Europe, really I think you could say the Seven Years' War is the first world war, the first global conflict.
I have often...
Global conflict at stake.
Yeah.
And then World War One, you know, I think anyone who's studied World War I at GCSE will know that this battle for empire is a major factor in the beginning of World War One. And then World War Two, you know, you look at Mussolini and his desire to build up an empire. So, it's a huge trend in European history and something which the book does touch on.
Sure.
There is that covered there,
Because, I mean, I often find one of the paradoxes of teaching World War One is that we call it a world war, try to think about it in school terms as being a European war. It's until very, very recently, the history of World War One, at least at a school level, has been kind of whitened. There is virtually in no history textbook that I've ever taught from mention of Sikh and Hindu and Muslim and African troops, Chinese, indentured workers on the Western Front. It's there's virtually nothing there. And the reason why I think it's important when you're looking at the history of Europe is that those kind of colonial connections are integral to the fighting of the war. By Britain and France, to a greater, much less extent, Germany, who used African troops in their colonies. Telling the story of this cataclysmic event in Europe, I find there's a kind of optimism at the moment in various histories I've read that start to look at the global picture of the war, looking at, you know, bits of the war fought in China and the Pacific and things like that. So there's a kind of like a paradox in the storytelling there, ever so slightly, and almost perhaps less so in the telling of the story of the Second World War.
Yeah, no, I think definitely a broad view of World War One as a global conflict is important, and even if we just look at it as a European conflict, most people can talk about the Western Front, and because it happens in France and Belgium, the names are a bit more familiar to us. People then will be able to talk about Gallipoli, but the Italian Front, the fighting in the Balkans, which is extremely savage, the fighting in Turkey and Greece, which goes on until 1919, 1920, and then, of course, the Eastern Front, happens over a huge area with lots of names which are difficult to pronounce, and all the towns have got Polish and German names, and these huge battles which are going on, which, you know, it's very hard to wrap your head around everything going on at the same time. And then you've got this world war on top of it, which I agree has to be assessed and thought about.
Mm-hmm. Coming back now to the present day, the kind of the crisis that we are in at the moment. Some people have suggested, I think it's quite a common assertion, that we're in a kind of a crisis, not even just of British, but actually kind of English exceptionalism, the idea that Britain, or really England, is special and different and not really subject to the ebb and flow of European history. Do you feel that that's a valid critique of the way Britain sees itself at the moment, or England? Or is there more to it than that?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Yeah, well, I certainly think a lot of this country's self-image, to a degree, goes back to World War II. Mm-hmm. And this notion that Britain stood alone and was this bulwark, and if it wasn't for Britain, you know, we'd always be in Germany. And I think that doesn't really do service to the great role that Commonwealth troops, you know, played in keeping Britain alive, or international shipping and the merchant navies who came from all over the world to keep food for this country, and also the very brave resistance fighters in Europe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we think about the European resistance, these people had no idea that the war was going to end in 1945.
No.
For all they knew, they could have been under Nazi occupation for the rest of their lives. And I think that's what makes what they did really brave. And, mm-hmm. and so I think that's an important thing to look up, think about. But at the same time, the achievement of Britain in just managing to hang on,
yeah,
you know, was huge and helped provide some tactical and strategic missteps on the hand of the German high command as well.
I think,
which, you know, but you have to take advantage of these opportunities.
There was a thing that Trotsky said about the Tsar, Nicholas II. He said that if history's blowing in your direction, you can't really go far wrong. If the events are kind of going the way that suit you. And if it's not, you've had it, basically. And I think that's a kind way of looking at, particularly at Winston Churchill during the war, that by and large, his genius, if you will, was about seeing the way the wind was blowing and being able to kind of capitalise on the moment. Obviously, he makes like a series of catastrophic errors, places things that, you know, disasters in Greece and things like that. But we was able to see that ultimately America probably would enter the war if the moment arose, and that hanging on was and keeping America appraised of the situation in all sorts of different ways, and keeping American public opinion on side was kind of the trick. And no doubt that there's you know, other things to be said in Churchill's favour, but I think that that's a more, for me, I've always thought that's a more realistic way of looking at Britain and the war. Than the kind of the kind of more flag-waving narrative, which I think is causing us, all sorts of problems at the moment. Do you find that if you take a titanic figure like Churchill, that his uses and abuses, the uses and abuses of the memory of him, can be quite problematic?
Yeah, I think you can get to some people so iconic that they just become binary figures, and you either have to say he was great unquestionably, and anyone who says differently is unpatriotic, or you can say he was a complete villain, and anyone who says differently is bigoted or something like that. And if you want to be a good historian, you have to think about the context of the time, the nuance of the time, mm-hmm. and actually, he was a bit of both. He was a very complex figure mm-hmm. Who was under an enormous amount of stress and who made a lot of bad decisions throughout his career, not just in World War II, but he was also enormously resilient. And I think he held together the international alliance, but also he has to hold together an alliance of the Labour Party mm-hmm. And Clement Attlee, which is something which I don't think the leaders of the Conservative and the Labour Party today could... No. Hold together an alliance under that kind of stress. So I think you have to sort of think about him in the round, I think.
And also, I mean, there's a point that comes perhaps at the Tehran conference, certainly by the Yalta conference, where Churchill, I think it's at Yalta, where Churchill says the big three have become the big two and a half. And he seems to have consumed some hard truths about Britain's role in the world and the durability of the empire. It seems actually, at that moment, remarkably out of character from the Churchill we previously know to be that sort of accepting, really, that Britain's time at the top table is pretty much over. Why do you think that he was capable of being that reflective?
Well, I think part of it, and I'm playing sort of amateur psychologist here, is that Churchill was not very well for a lot of the war.
No.
He was under significant health problems. He had pneumonia, I think one or two heart attacks during the war, and he was a kind of robust guy, so it's amazing he survived it. And actually, I think you get a sense of your own mortality, and then I think you think about your country. And then when you're running the war and you see the huge scale of what's going on, things like the Lend-Lease operation, mm-hmm. and you know exactly what the United States' industrial output is, and also you have some idea of just how many troops the Soviet Union have, I think he must have realised that the United Kingdom, for all of its worse and all of its advantages, in the long run, it's going to be a two-power world. Mm-hmm. And you have to do your best to negotiate that situation and win the war, and then try and forge some sort of peace which was advantageous to Britain, as Churchill understood it.
Because we're in this extraordinary situation, aren't we, where the pillars of Churchill's post-war world were the Commonwealth, the Atlantic bond, and Europe. He basically proposed, I don't know quite how far he saw Britain as being a part of this, but he said basically a Commonwealth of Europe should emerge, and this is going to be a wholly good thing, and the sooner we can rehabilitate the Germans, so much the better. Obviously, the British Empire is long gone. There are these kind of Brexiteer fantasies about Empire 2.0, which I think already when you start to say that in public, probably the game's up. The first empire was more of a game of stealth than that. And we have this hugely unreliable relationship in the White House, which didn't begin with Donald Trump. Britain's shaky Atlantic relationships have not begun with the election of Donald Trump. So We've got this atrophying one by one of Churchill's pillars of Britain's world position, and the kind of the severing of links with Europe, kind of for a group of Tory politicians that worship at Churchill's statue, they have really taken apart the world that he tried to create. Now, I suppose the question is whilst that seems kind of absurd, and I suspect it probably is it fairly standard, do we think, that these kind of ties, these alliances, these strategic positions that countries take inevitably come to an end at a certain point, and we go into, and nations go into a state of flux, really, as to where they are in the world? Is this a kind of a common pattern?
Well, I think if you look at history in the very long view, since, I guess, the early modern period, you have a series of great powers emerge in Europe, and everything is a response to keeping that great power under control. And so in the 16th century, it's Spain. In the 17th century, it's France. And then from the 18th century, you try and have an idea of a balance of power being kept, and you have this series of shifting alliances. And that really holds true until, I think, after World War II, if you want to really extend it. And I think what has been the great achievement of the kind of EU extended project, which starts after the war, is that it stopped this confrontational alliance-making system where one, it all takes is one state to go to another side, mm-hmm. for the situation to be unbalanced. Mm-hmm. So the EU project has only lasted, historically, the blink of an eye, mm-hmm. but certainly it's delivered one of the longest periods of continuous peace. Western Europe, has certainly seen, mm-hmm. As well as delivering a high degree of prosperity. Mm-hmm. How much that would have happened without the EU is open to question, but I certainly think that it does stop this very damaging cycle of alliance, counter-alliance, war building up.
And now we shift towards a world that is less based on multilateralism and more something that you might have recognised in the 19th century. We have a kind of a hyper-nationalist America, China, a resurgent India, countries such as Erdogan's Turkey and obviously Putin's Russia, all jostling more as the great powers of the 19th century would have done. And a kind of an atrophying, not just of the EU, but you have Trump, for example, rolling not completely, but sort of rowing back from NATO, sustained attacks on the legitimacy of UN institutions. This kind of crumbling of multilateralism seems to be happening. Why do you think that we're going through this transition? What is making this shift in the world?
Well, I think in one respect, it's a response in a way to globalization, response to a feeling of uncertainty and powerlessness in the form of a globalizing economy where national governments aren't necessarily the final arbiter of how a country goes. And I certainly think the 2008-9-10 crisis, mm-hmm. did shake a lot of people's worldviews and trust in institutions. Yeah. And one of the great benefits of the EU is, at least theoretically, the institutions are accountable, mm-hmm. to the people of Europe. And I think when people think that the institutions don't care about them and don't listen to them, they can turn to people who say, actually, we're going to just tear this down and look inwards and take care of ourselves, even though I think certainly economically, it's just impossible for a country to fold in on itself. Yeah. We're too linked to each other, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, you may find, I mean, it's impossible to predict the future, and that's not really our job as historians, is it? But you may find that this is a kind of a kink in the road to ever greater levels of globalization, or it's something more than that. It's some greater rupture. But it would be difficult, I would say, difficult to argue that kind of a process of globalization that's been going on roughly since the Tudors is going to ground to a halt now, particularly as you see the advances of technology that we see. But the European Union, it's interesting to contemplate in this less multilateral world where an institution based on multilateralism sits, because so far it hasn't done much to fight back against the kind of the vice it's in between Putin on one side, Trump on the other, and perhaps Erdogan on the other. It seems hemmed in without having done a kind of a great deal, but who knows?
Yeah, well, I think the European Union is a huge bureaucracy, and the wheels of the bureaucracy turn very slowly sometimes. And that became one of the problems of the old Soviet Union, just becomes choked up with levels of bureaucracy. And I think that is one of the issues that the European Union will have to face, is how can it be more nimble and think on its feet and react to these other large countries? And one of the ways they react is to become even more integrated. Another way to react will become a much looser association. So I think really the institution of the EU has to reassess how it's going to operate in the 21st century for it to, you know, carry on and achieving its mission.
Yeah. Great. Well, Jacob, thank you so much for your time. It's been a very, very illuminating chat. I'll be putting this live out later on. But if anybody out there wants to get a copy, it is The History of Europe in Bite-Sized Chunks by Jacob Field, a snip at $9.99, available from all good bookshops, and certainly the kind of useful go-to reference guide that any modern historian should have. Thanks very much, Jacob, and hopefully, would it be possible to have you back on the show again at some point in the future for a...
Sure, I would love to speak, certainly after whatever is going to happen with the UK and the European Union comes to light. If you need a historical perspective on that,
I would love that.
To come back and see what's going to happen.
I'll drop you a line. I'd love that. Thanks so much. All the best.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.